From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the husband of Laura Levis, who died outside a Somerville hospital in 2016, on understanding the impacts of asthma.
I am stronger after 3 years. I miss her every day. But by trying to help save someone else's life, by sharing her story, I hope that it makes a difference.
Also today, when public figures offend, do we cancel them or forgive them?
You know, when you think about people in your life, when they act stupid, you don't just cancel them. We know that real relationships are more nuanced.
We'll take your calls. And monsters come to Wakefield in The Last Kids on Earth.
It's like the sort of adventure that we don't get to sort of see that much anymore. It's just kids on their own getting into trouble and like saving the day in a really fun, gigantic way.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are right in the middle of asthma peak week, the worst week of the year for asthma-related complications. Despite the pleasant temperatures outside, September brings a perfect storm. Ragweed pollen converges with leafy mold spores. Kids go back to school. The flu season begins in earnest. And it's a time of year that many asthma sufferers might not even know about. Folks like Laura Levis. On September 16th, 2016, she suffered a particularly severe asthma attack. She walked to CHA Somerville Hospital, found the door to the emergency room locked, and she called 911. Help, which was just on the other side of that door, didn't arrive in time. She died a week later at 34. Her husband, Peter DeMarco, wrote about what happened to his wife in the Boston Globe magazine last year, and he has a new piece on asthma peak week for WBUR's Cognoscenti. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, I can't thank you enough for giving me time today to be on your show to tell people about this dangerous disease, asthma, and particularly how dangerous it is this week.
What do you want people to know, Peter?
I want them to know something that Laura never knew. That this week in particular, in September, the third week, asthma experts say is the worst for anyone with asthma. I want people with asthma and anyone you know, anyone you love who has asthma, to know that they need to be vigilant about carrying inhalers this week, having their nebulizer fluids stocked up at home, and especially when they have an attack, for them to tell someone. It doesn't matter if they've had 100 attacks in their lives, that have all gone fine. It's so important to tell someone, to have someone on your side, to let them know, hey, I'm going through this at this moment. Maybe that person can just calm them down, because asthma is a disease that preys upon panic. Or maybe that person can help them get help if the attack becomes more severe.
Peter, I've been a lifelong asthma sufferer. I was a severe childhood asthma sufferer, and I often was hospitalized in September. And until today, I met you and you told me about peak week, I always thought it was just me. I never knew it was a thing. Have we always known it was a thing? Is this new information?
Asthma experts, asthma doctors I've spoken with, they have tracked this for several years. It's something that they've basically by experience, hey, people coming to the ER, our patients are complaining of asthma attacks. They've known about this for years. But amazingly, I don't think the word has gotten out there. I spent 10 months researching Laura's story for the Boston Globe. I thought I knew almost every detail about that horrible morning. But I didn't know about this piece of asthma. I didn't know about this until just a couple months ago. And if Laura had known about peak week, maybe she would have done something differently. Maybe she would have been taking extra precautions. I wasn't with her that morning. I wish so much I was. But if she had just known about this, maybe she would have done one thing differently that would have saved her life. And it's so important for people with asthma to know just to do one extra thing this week to protect themselves.
Peter, I know this is painful for you. But can you tell us what happened on that day in September 2016?
Laura had her asthma attack around 4 a.m., which is usually around the time her asthma attack struck, the most severe ones. She had had probably 4 or 5 severe attacks during our entire time together. We were together 12 years. And in those times, we always had time to go to the hospital, to drive to the hospital. I was always with her. On this particular morning, I was not. And she was just a few blocks away from CHA Somerville Hospital, and she just decided to walk there on her own. She packed a backpack with her gym clothes for the day. Laura was incredibly fit, incredibly athletic. She lifted weights. She did spin classes. She was the epitome of health. And she had asthma. She made it to the hospital that morning, and everything that could have gone wrong did. There was no emergency room sign for her to follow. The door she tried outside the emergency room was locked. She called 911 for help and told them where she was, but her cell phone pinged in the wrong location. That sent emergency responders to the wrong place of the hospital. There was no one at the security desk all night at the hospital. It was left unattended. And when a call was finally made to the emergency room to go look for Laura, staff members were not trained, and they did nothing more than take one look out the door. They did not walk outside the hospital to look for Laura. She was 29 feet from the door of the hospital on a bench. Her asthma attack had become so severe by then that she collapsed.
Peter, I'm incredibly sorry. It was 3 years ago. How are you?
Well, this week is bringing up so many emotions. So many emotions that it's not that I put them away, but sometimes you just have to compartmentalize your grief when it's so great. And certainly I've had to try to push forward with some of the advocacy work I've been doing and to get Laura's story out there. I am stronger after 3 years. And I miss her every day. But by trying to help save someone else's life by sharing her story, be it through asthma or through some of the other initiatives to improve our 911 system or improve access for patients to hospitals, I hope that it makes a difference. And I guess I hope it's making a difference.
So you are doing so much to try to make a difference in other people's lives. Let's talk about some of your advocacy. One of the things that you're doing is working on a bill called Laura's Law, after your wife, which Laura's name, obviously, which would require all hospitals in Massachusetts to ensure safe patient access at all times, whether that's a panic button, a doorbell. What's the progress on Laura's Law?
Yeah. What this bill that that we filed, I have to thank Senator Pat Jalin and Representative Christine Barber. They have co-sponsored this bill there, our Somerville representatives. This bill would allow the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts for the first time to create standards for such important elements as hospital signage, lighting, security monitoring of doors. It would allow them to set standards for wayfinding, which is the entire sort of science of finding your way into a building and around a building. There are no standards. They don't exist in Massachusetts. The only time the Department of Public Health can do anything is when a brand new hospital is built. And people don't build new hospitals.
So where does that bill stand now?
Next week is a very important week. On September 24th, Tuesday at 1 o'clock, the Joint Committee on Public Health at the State House is going to hear Laura's Law. They're going to hear our bill. They're going to hear testimony from people who think this bill is important for access for people with functional impairments, for people with asthma. They're going to hear from me. They're going to hear from Cambridge Health Alliance.
They own the Somerville.
Exactly.
The hospital.
Yeah.
So you've also been fighting to lift the cap on suing
public hospitals, which CHA Somerville is, many people might not know that that cap is maxed out at $100,000. Where does that work stand?
Sure. I have not sued the hospital, and nor really could I. There are laws in Massachusetts that protect hospitals from being sued, even in cases of wrongful death, even in cases of egregious harm. I had an option to try to pursue this in court. The lawyers I went to the biggest law firm in Boston, and they said, for $100,000, we can't afford to bring your case to trial.
Mm.
There was de facto no way to sue.
In all sort of practicality, you mean?
Correct. I actually could have filed a lawsuit and likely would have spent more of my own money to pursue a verdict. To me, it's not about money. It's never been about money. Money doesn't bring Laura back. But accountability is important in our society, and so are apologies, and so is justice. Families in situations such as the one that I found myself in, who have had loved ones harmed by medical errors, they often don't have any legal recourse. For me, I guess by the grace of God, I had become a journalist, and I was able to write Laura's story, to try to inspire some change, to try to make sure that other people's lives won't be lost, and also to hold institutions accountable.
Peter, you are a storyteller. So now, 3 years later, how would you like Laura to be remembered?
Laura was this incredibly vibrant, funny, smart, beautiful, strong, so strong woman. She was this incredible light when she entered a room, and her light was only getting brighter. Putting Laura's story out there has been so difficult, and putting her name out there and her face out there has not been easy. But I have to think that Laura would want other people to be saved because of her death, because she was that strong a person. I hope that when people think of her, they think of her smile and her laughter and her strength.
Peter DeMarco is the founder of the Lift for Laura Foundation. You can find a link to his WBUR Cognoscenti essay at our website, radioboston.org. Peter, thanks for being with us.
I can't thank you enough for having me here today and for sharing about Peak Week.
We'll hear more from Peter DeMarco tomorrow on WBUR's Morning Edition. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Comedian Shane Gillis has been effectively canceled. At least that's how some people see his removal from Saturday Night Live just 4 days after he was hired. He was fired for racist remarks he made on a podcast in 2018. To illustrate, here's a clip of an offending conversation he had on that podcast with co-host Matt McCusker. Gillis is talking about Asian people who don't speak English well in restaurants. Again, some listeners will find his remarks offensive.
It's funny, too, because that's more annoying than any other minority playing music at a restaurant, loud on their phone.
Do you think
an Asian trying to learn English bothers me more than someone listening to, like, Lil Uzi Vert while I'm trying to eat dinner?
That's hilarious.
Some have pushed back against the move from SNL, saying the show gave in to a toxic cancel culture that's gone too far. Joining us to talk about this is Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor Renee Graham. Renee, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Also joining us via Skype is Susan Jane, who is a culture critic, writer, and principal at Navigators Consulting. She's a contributor to WBUR's The Artery and wrote a piece on the cancel culture earlier this year. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. What do you think of cancel culture and this idea of boycotting public figures who do or say something offensive? Is it productive or has it gone too far? How else can we hold people in the public eye accountable for wrongdoings? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, let's start with Shane Gillis. Renee, do you think SNL made the right move, and why or why not?
I think they did make the right move. I mean, I don't understand how they
didn't see this to begin with, given the fact that we're talking about comments he made a year ago on a podcast. So, you know, the fact that people brought this to their attention and that there were so many, you know, we're not talking about a one-off and the things that he said. There were comments, there were anti-Asian comments, there were homophobic comments. I mean, you know, there was a pattern here. So I think SNL absolutely really had no choice. They don't want to go into the new season with this hanging over their head. So they got rid of their problem.
Susan, do you agree or disagree?
I do agree that it was the right move. There are tons of comedians who would like an opportunity to be on SNL. And I think that the show has every right to make choices that they think are going to appeal to the audience that they're trying to reach. We live in different times. You need to be more accountable for the things that you say. And shows want to reach a broad audience. And that includes people that Shane may have found his way too offending. And so I think it was a smart move for them. But I agree with Renee. They should have done their vetting earlier on, and then it wouldn't have been an issue.
So, Renee, you wrote about this kind of cancel culture moment in the Boston Globe this week. Many public figures and celebrities, they're being called out. They're being called upon to be boycotted for problematic things that they did or said. Sometimes this dates back years. What do you think has sparked this moment? It wasn't always like this.
It wasn't always like this. I mean, obviously I think social media plays an enormous role in this because it amplifies any kind of statement someone makes or something that someone finds. It's retweeted, it's liked, and that's how it gains a certain momentum. But this wasn't always happening because I think there was definitely a culture where people felt like, well, you know, I'm a white man, I can say what I want, and everyone else has to shut up about it. And once the problem is that, you know, women, people of color, members of the LGBTQ community decided we don't have to be silent anymore. And if this offends us, we can say something about it.
Susan, that gives a lot of power to, I don't know how to lay people, right? It puts a lot of power into the hands of fans and lay people in social media to kind of really affect the lives of other people. How do you feel about that?
I think it's about time. If we want you to spend your time and your money on our media constructions, we should be responsive to you as a client and a customer. And I think as media companies are understanding that they do need to appeal to these broader audiences, to these other audiences they may not have listened to before, but these audiences spend money. And when they spend their money, they deserve to have representations and media constructions that really are a reflection of what they want to spend their time and money listening to. So I think it makes a lot of sense. If you want to expand your audience to include people that might have been previously marginalized, you have a responsibility to ask what they want and to put in front of them people that respect them.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. What should we do when a public figure offends? Do we cancel? Do we forgive? Is there some other way? Let's take a call. Paul from Lunenburg, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My first thought was, this reminded me of the Brett Kavanaugh story just the other day. You know, where's our conversation around who learns from mistakes and changes and who doesn't? And I'm not equating the two, and I'm not forgiving either of them, but we don't seem to be having a conversation about what we as a culture want if all we do is shut down people when they make mistakes. So I'd be interested to hear about that.
Well, good, Paul. And I'm going to turn that to Susan because your piece for The Artery back in March called Leaving Neverland, which was about Michael Jackson's sexual assault allegations, you argued about trading cancel culture for reconciliation. And Paul is saying, like, you know, don't people change? Isn't there room? So talk about that a little bit, Susan.
We absolutely want there to be room for growth. In a culture in the future where everybody is respected, when people make mistakes, they have an opportunity to make reconciliation and to come back. And I think that's really important. That's part of the toxicity of our current state of cancel culture, is there isn't that room for people to think about, how do I learn? How do I grow from this? Now, that being said, maybe you don't need to grow while you're getting a paycheck in the public eye. Maybe you need to go handle your business and do some work on yourself. But we do want to think about, what does reconciliation look like? That's nowhere in our culture. And in our binary culture of being canceled or not, it doesn't show how do people grow. And I think you're right, Paul, that it's really important to think about, how does that growth happen? And should you hold power while you're learning?
So, Renee, in your piece this week, you say this isn't about cancel culture. This is about consequences. And it does seem, if you really look at reconciliation processes. Types of consequences are a piece of that healing process. So are you in a different place than Susan, or are you on the same page but a different part in the part of the process?
Well, look, let's first clarify what we mean when we say someone has made a mistake. Shane Gillis did not make a mistake.
Fair point.
You know, I think that's a really important point to make here. It's not like he made fun of Asians and realized that it was wrong to make fun of Asians. He defended his right to do that.
Yeah, he's been very clear about that. Yes.
Right.
And I think even our language around that is, are they making a mistake or they were really being who they were? That's important.
Well, it's not a mistake. And I don't know that I would call sexual assault a mistake either. So, right. You know, if the idea is that this thing happened and you're still not acknowledging that it happened and you have, you know, witnesses or more than one victim, then where's the mistake exactly? How does the person redeem themselves from something that isn't a mistake at all?
So
and I think that's what's wrong right there, that language of saying, well, a person made a mistake. A lot of these people haven't made mistakes. These are deliberate actions.
So let's
what
take,
do you think?
Yeah, no, go ahead, Susan, please.
I was going to say, what do you think about referring to it as causing harm? Because that has less to do with intentionality or whether it was a mistake or not. But that does acknowledge that people do harm and that there needs to be a way to address people who do harm, sometimes grievous harm.
But it that falls into that category where people will say, I'm sorry if you were offended. Causing harm, I don't like the wishy-washiness of that term. You know, it's again, Shane Gillis did what he did to get a laugh. He did it at the expense of gay people and Asians. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew the audience he was playing to.
I want to play a cut here. This is comedian Dave Chappelle. He famously lamented cancel culture in his recent Netflix stand-up special Sticks and Stones. Let's listen.
If you do anything wrong in your life, and I find out about it, I'm going to try to take everything away from you. And I don't care what I find out. It could be today, tomorrow, 15, 20 years from now. If I find out, you're finished. Who's that? That's you. This is the worst time ever to be a celebrity. You're going to be finished. Everyone's doomed.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. That is not an apologetic stance over offense.
No.
but it is a strong pushback that says, if you listen to Chappelle's whole show. It's a set of strong statements about I may offend, but I may be doing this on purpose, but I should be allowed to push the boundaries as part of my work. So where does that fit into this conversation as well? Boundary pushing. And I think maybe we have to come out comedy, for example, from, let's say, an elected official as well, where the social contract is different, sort of the choice of your relationship with that person is different. I'm sorry, I just said like 52 things, and now I want you guys to make it all sound awesome. But I'm going to invite you to react to any of that.
I mean, I can jump in. I love Dave Chappelle, but Dave, I don't have to choose you. I don't have to choose you, and I don't have to cancel you to not choose you.
He says, hey, if you're listening to me, it's because you clicked on my show. You don't have to click.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we are, is we're shifting the agreements. And as we do, people are choosing what they like and what they... Look, if you want to make some horrible, disgusting jokes, you have every right to do that. And I have every right to say, you're out of pocket. That's not okay for me to hear, and I don't want to hear that in my community.
Renee, is that sufficient consequence from your perspective?
I mean, where the conversation breaks down is where Dave Chappelle says, you know, celebrities should be allowed to push the boundaries. But he's also implying that audience don't have the right to push back.
Mm.
So how come celebrities only get to push, but we don't? And when we do it, we're small-minded and we're social justice warriors and we're snowflakes.
I want to bring a caller in here. We've got Chris from Brighton on the line. Chris, add to the discussion.
Yeah, I would just say, don't people have to have sort of, keep some of that thick skin around for this type of situation? It's a comedian, and the content has historically come from outside the box, and you know, if you don't want to listen, don't listen. But you should. He's attempting. He may have failed at the time, but he was just attempting to be humorous.
Thanks for that, Chris. So let me come back. Go ahead. I hear somebody ready to go.
I will say something about Dave Chappelle. Years ago, Dave Chappelle told a story about doing the Chappelle Show, and he had walked away from the show at the height of its popularity, and he tells a story about making a racist joke, and somebody in the audience just laughed too long, and he realized they weren't in on the progressive views. They were laughing at the racism, and he walked away from it all at the height of his career. So I don't know where that Dave is, but how do people kind of navigate those boundaries? And I have to say, you know, as somebody in a marginalized community, you got to have a thick skin just to walk out the door during the day. And so when I relax with some comedy, I want it to be fun. And like, I love Desus and Mero. They're incredibly irreverent, and they also are respectful of communities I care about.
Renee, I heard you say, do you want to add to that?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm a member of a marginalized community as well. And, you know, don't tell me I don't have a thick skin. I'm a newspaper columnist. I have to have a thick skin. But when I write something someone doesn't like, they'll simply say, I think you should be fired. Now, are they trying to cancel me because they don't agree with what I said? You know, people make those decisions all the time. If you're right, if you don't want to listen, then you don't listen. That's not cancel culture. That's choice.
So Washington Post columnist Alexandra Petrie recently wrote about how what some people say, you know, hey, this is harmless fun, can actually be really harmful to real people. I'm just going to quote from her piece. Quote, fun is when no one is harmed, when no one real, no nice young fellows with promising careers who are allowed to say, just kidding, anytime they want, are endangered, end quote. She was talking about Kavanaugh there. This was about, you know, the accusations against him. But it does begin to raise this consideration about, you know, if you were marginalized, you were always on the oh, I was just kidding end of it. You were not allowed to raise your voice and say, hey, that's offensive. So are we just looking at the empowerment of people who have been the butt of the jokes for too long? Is that what's happening?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, I mentioned that in my column when there was a racist incident in my workplace years ago, and a white male colleague was, you know, lamenting this time when you could just say anything. And he didn't recognize that that was a miserable time for women and people of color and in the LGBT community. You know, you stayed quiet because you felt like you had no choice. And for him, what was great was terrible for the rest of us. So I think that's part of the pushback as well. It's like, who do these people think they are now crashing our party?
So 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I want to bring in another caller voice. Pepper from Beverly, you've been waiting a while. I'd love to have you add to the conversation. Pepper, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Pepper. Please join the conversation.
Yeah, hi. I heard on talk radio sports this morning something I thought about, which is if anybody should be called out, and what's the term you're using?
Canceled,
like
cancel culture.
Canceled. It's the New England Patriots. You got Robert Kraft, who has done some terrible things, and now he just hired an alleged woman abuser as a wide receiver, and the talk radio this morning was saying, yeah, and they ran him on like every play from the beginning as if to say, fully on you, the people who objected.
So that's kind of consequence-free for the Pats. Thank you, Pepper. And I want to clarify, Robert Kraft has been accused of soliciting prostitution last February in Florida. And Antonio Brown, the new wide receiver for the New England Patriots, was named in a civil lawsuit last week for 3 counts of sexual assault and sexually aggressive behavior. Susan, do you want to react to Pepper and his point there? You know, are we giving a total pass to these sports stars?
Well, I don't watch the NFL because I stand with Cap. But on that, I would say that when we look at the Patriots, and I think something that it really points out is it's easy to cancel people that maybe told a joke you didn't like or maybe that are kind of on the periphery. What happens when it's the team you really love? How do you hold the people that are a part of your community accountable? And I think that that's the question that sports has a lot of opportunity to offer. Because it's not just a guy that owns a team, it's a team that's in your community, that is connected to people you know. They live where you live. And so that's why canceling, we can cancel people, but guess what? Robert Kraft still lives in this community and the Patriots are still the Patriots. So how do we ask our organizations to be reflective of the communities that they serve? And then, you know, like with a team that you really love, how do you walk that line? How do you make that decision? Do I kneel with Cap or do I stand with the Patriots?
So, Renee, Susan just said a lot there, but one thread I really want to pick up on is, Susan, you made two references to former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick and his original decision to kneel during the national anthem during NFL football games and his being shut out of the NFL, largely as a result. Renee, one of the points that you make in your Boston Globe argument is that some people get more canceled than others. And I wonder if I can invite you to talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting when you talk about what happened to Colin Kaepernick. I mean, you know, he took a stand against racial injustice and police violence. He took a stand to address something to make this country better. And essentially, he was effectively banned from the game. And I don't remember a lot of the people who are complaining about cancel culture now talking about what happened and continues to happen to Colin Kaepernick. And that's why I canceled the NFL from my life 2 years ago. That's what it means to be canceled, when a group of billionaires conspire to deprive a man of his livelihood. So we're talking about, you know, a very kind of different thing here with the NFL. You know, to pick up on a point, though, that Susan did make, right, it is hard. But I think with the Patriots, I think so long as they keep winning and racking up rings, I don't think a lot of their fans are going to care what Robert Kraft's been involved with, or especially what the players are going through, such as Antonio Brown. I don't think it even makes a dent, because right now the Patriots are 2-0, and that's all people care about.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join this conversation, Nathan from Arlington, what do you have to say?
Yeah, hi. I think that last comment touched on especially relates to a very crucial point that I just wanted to emphasize, is that the real question is who holds the power in these situations. So certainly the Kaepernick example is great to bring up there. But what I wanted to say, one caller brought up that about comedians. I'm talking about, so compare Colin Kaepernick to Shane Gillis, to bring it back, to say that, oh, comedians need to push boundaries. Shane Gillis was just pushing boundaries to do his work. But I would argue in that context, racist jokes are not pushing boundaries or developing anything new. It's not coming up with anything new. Racist jokes, just like the ones made by Shane Gillis against Asian Americans, are old news, have been around for a long time, and I think what has at least been partially said before is that people are tired of that.
Thanks, Nathan. I appreciate that call. There's a piece here that is about hierarchies of sort of where the bar sits for how much consequence you should pay. And it does seem like we've got, okay, elected official in one place, sports star in another place, comedian in another place, and money and power having a lot to do with what that outcome is going to be. Is there any potential, assuming that you want there to be consequences, is there potential to level that playing field over time? Or are those disparities just with us, Susan?
I think those are powerful examples of the disparities that are really at the heart of this battle. And as you said, the central question is who holds power and who gets to hold it over whom and how much and for how long. And that's the question at the heart of the battles we're having around racism, around sexism, around transphobia, all of those issues. And I think what you're seeing is that, you know, maybe people like Bob Kraft have had all the power before, but now regular people, because of the super fueling power of social media, regular people have a chance to get in on that conversation. And I think that it's just going to be a conversation. We're going to have it for a while, and it's going to be a struggle, and we just got to stick with it and get through.
I want to get one more call in here. Dean from Hyde Park, please go ahead. Join the conversation.
Hi, I just wanted to make a quick comment. At least one or possibly twice in this show, Brett Kavanaugh's name has been brought up. There is a difference between offensive conduct and criminal conduct. Christine Blasey Ford wasn't offended by a joke. She was sexually assaulted. And Brett Kavanaugh didn't tell a joke that was off color or racist. He lied to Congress and to the FBI. There is a big difference there.
Okay, Dean, thanks for that. I do need to say those are both allegations. He has not been criminally accused or convicted. There is this distinction between what offends and what assaults, Renee. Are we being thoughtful enough in our distinctions and our conversations about who gets consequences?
I think we are. I mean, I think a few things on this. I mean, I think, again, it is about power, as Susan mentioned. It's very, you know, you look at the situation again with the NFL and Colin Kaepernick. The billionaires were in a position to take away his livelihood. No one's taking away Shane Gillis's livelihood. You know,
Shane Gillis, just to remind listeners that, you know, the one who was just removed from the cast of Saturday Night Live.
Right, who was hired and then fired by Saturday Night Live. Yeah. No one's taking away his livelihood. You know, SNL has a decision on who they want in their cast. They decide they didn't want him. That's it. He'll move on. He'll go on to something else. You know, I think that's what we have to remember. And again, yes, we're not talking about, you know, criminal activity or alleged criminal activity. That's a separate category. And no one is saying that, you know, Bill Cosby was a victim of cancel culture or that Harvey Weinstein was a victim of cancel culture. Their cases are much more clear cut. But we are talking about the idea of a culture of respect. And if you don't do that now, there are repercussions for that. However, yes, it does make a difference. I mean, you know, we have, you know, Sean Spicer on Dancing with the Stars. And boy, has he not paid any consequences for essentially being a professional liar for the Trump administration.
So, Susan, we've got 30 seconds left. And my last question to you is there a road to rehabilitation after this, you know, after a serious offense outside the criminal justice system? And how do we think about that?
Reconciliation. We can look to other countries and other cultures that really have dealt with large difficulties and how do you settle those difficulties between whole communities of people. And it's not really a part of our narrative, and we need to make it that.
All right. That was Susan Jane joining us via Skype. She's a culture critic, writer, and principal at Navigators Consulting and a contributor to WBUR's The Artery. Susan, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor Renee Graham. She's got an op-ed in The Globe on cancel culture. Renee, thanks for joining Radio Boston today.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, author Max Brallier on what he means by funpocalypse. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Life as a 13-year-old can be pretty scary. Now add in a giant evil rat, a zombie horde, and Godzilla-sized monsters. That is just what our next guest, author Max Brallier, does in his book series, The Last Kids on Earth. The books are being turned into an animated series on Netflix. The first episode, a one-hour special, premiered yesterday. The fifth book in the series, The Last Kids on Earth and the Midnight Blade, was also released yesterday. We spoke with Max, who grew up in Reading, Massachusetts, and sets his series in a town called Wakefield. And I wanted to know, is this story about a group of 13-year-olds battling zombies and monsters, just trying to survive, is this a metaphor for the epic struggles and chaos that are the middle school experience?
I don't think that I intended necessarily to be that, but I did intend for the things that the main character, Jack Sullivan, goes through in this sort of end-of-the-world scenario, to be like a larger, gigantic monster version of the sort of trauma and just miserableness that kids experience in middle school.
That totally resonates. It also feels like the story at its core really is about the friendship among these kids. They really have each other's backs. Here's a clip from the series.
We can't stay here. He'll tear this place apart.
No, we're gonna stay and defend it. My whole life, I've never had a home worth fighting for or friends to share it with. Now I do. And I'm not giving it up without a fight! I'm not
gonna... Less speeches, more fighting!
That's awesome. Was the power of this friendship really your focus in the storytelling?
Yes. I knew when I first started writing it, I was like, I'm going to write something about monsters and there's going to be zombies and there's going to be lots of action. And I'm going to have a big like James Bond sort of vehicle that the main characters drive around in, even though they're only in sixth grade. And that'll just be cool and cool and cool and cool and cool. And then when I started writing it, I was like, oh, right. Like the heart is what makes me enjoy all the stuff that I like. There's like a heart to it and there's a friendship and there's like a sort of family element. And so that very much became like the center of it. And now the action kind of turns around that and turns on that, the relationships and the friendships and the like the buddy-buddy camaraderie. I was very much influenced by like the Goonies and things like that that I loved growing up and still love today.
And I didn't think of the Goonies, but it really, there is kind of a channel to that. How did you tap back into your own younger voice? Because the voice, the Jack's voice, the other kids' voices are so authentic. How did you tap back into that?
Frighteningly, it was very easy and didn't take much. I think that it's just my voice, and that's like scary to think about. I'm raising a kid right now. That's really frightening. But in terms of the way Jack talks and the sort of the things that he thinks about, and he wants to have at least 5 different crossbows on his treehouse and also a bunch of catapults and also a big screen TV with a video game center, that's just like what I want if I could build my apartment from the ground up.
Well, who wouldn't? Good point.
Yeah, right? Like, so I think I just sort of, it's easy for me to tap into that. The only times it ever gets tough is when I try to make, like, I even for like pop culture stuff, I still stick to things that I know and love, like the Goonies and Indiana Jones and Star Wars. A few times I'll flirt around with things like Fortnite or stuff that I'm not that familiar with. And that's when I have to rely on like asking students questions during school visits.
So your book is kind of a hybrid. Can you talk a little bit about the very specific style?
Yeah, so I never know what to call it. I don't think anybody does. Anybody in publishing?
I clearly
anybody
didn't.
In books? Nope, nobody does. Don't worry. It's not just you. It's like a hybrid. Some people call it an illustrated novel. But yeah, it's like a mixture of text and illustration. And it's nice for me because it lets me write the stuff that I want to write. And then when something seems intimidating to write, I just go, illustration here. And then I let Douglas Holgate, the brilliant illustrator, do all the heavy lifting.
Well, that would make it easy to work through.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the series has been turned into this animated show on Netflix. It's got this bright, colorful look. It's not really what you think of or expect when you're thinking about a post-apocalyptic, zombie-filled world. But I read an interview with your co-showrunner, Scott Peterson. He actually used the term funpocalypse. How important was it to capture both the fun and the post-apocalyptic all in one vibe?
First of all, I'm the one that coined funpocalypse.
Okay, we'll give you formal
credit. No, just kidding. So it was early on, like one of the important things that just even when I was doing and the books are black and white, but like the idea was that it would still look like happy and fun. And there's a sort of sense of weird wish fulfillment in this series where, yes, the world has ended, but this is about kids who can now do whatever they wanted to do. When I was creating this series and thinking about what it would be, I had trouble like finding a way to sort of create that kind of classic Goonies thing because of cell phones and the constant connection between parents and kids and the whole world just being so connected. So I was like, maybe I just need to wipe out the whole world. And then just give, you know, the kids can have their own, like their whole hometown is their playground. And they race go-karts through the streets and they have battles with giant monsters at CVS. And the sky is still bright and blue and the grass is growing and it smells nice. And so it's not this really dark gray broken concrete all the time world. It's like the world has ended and there are zombies and these big brightly colored monsters, but it's still very fun.
You know, I'm glad to hear about the blue sky and, you know, there's still some fresh grass, et cetera, because the book takes place in a town named Wakefield. You're from Reading.
Yes.
I kind of took that as a tip of the hat, and I don't really like to think of Wakefield in a post-apocalyptic gray mist. So first, was that a tip to the real Wakefield?
It was. I wanted to do a tip to the real Reading, but that word looks like reading, and it's confusing. I remember I moved there in third grade, and they had all those signs in our classrooms about like how wonderful reading is and like how reading is the best thing for a child, and reading is fundamental, and reading is important. And I thought it was talking about Reading, and I went home to my parents, and I was like, this town you took us to is really weird. I think there's like a cult. So I went with Wakefield, which just seemed like a more digestible, easy to understand, like, oh, it's a town called Wakefield. But yeah, and a lot of the locations in the books are taken from my childhood.
So have you heard from Wakefield? Do you like have a key to the city now or anything like that? Or are they mad at you for blowing it up and putting in zombies and monsters instead?
Neither. I don't think I've heard a darn thing. I've heard from Reading, and I've done, like, I got to do some school visits at my old elementary school, my old middle school, which was really, really just amazing. That was, like, a very cool moment to, like, walk back and go to my old locker and be like, wow, a lot of the action is set, like, in my old middle school. And so it's just really crazy. But Wakefield, I haven't heard from you guys.
All right, Wakefield, wake up.
Step up.
There you go. So listen, there are a lot of Star Wars references in the book, and I understand that Mark Hamill, who is of course Luke Skywalker, is doing some voice work for the show. So at the risk of sounding a little simple, how cool is that?
It's still like I can't really believe that happened. I got to go into the studio, and at one point I very obnoxiously like was like, actually, you should read the line like this, and kind of like you're emphasizing the wrong word, Luke. No, but I really did have this kind of, like, it's very strange and amazing and too weird and too cool for me to get over. I mean, I think after we found out that he had accepted one of the roles, I was like weird about it for like a month, and I woke my wife up in the middle of the night and I was like, is this real or is this like an alternate weird timeline? Because it was just so bizarre that like this was happening, and it was so, like, I wrote all these Star Wars references in the books 4 years before there was a TV show, because I wouldn't be a writer or wouldn't be telling stories or anything if it wasn't for Star Wars.
Amazing. All right, so there are a lot of monsters, especially zombies, in the book. And zombies have been having a moment for a while now. So why do you think we have such a fascination with that particular type of monster?
It's like the longest moment in the history of moments. They've been having a moment now. Like, I wanted to write zombie stories back in, like, the early 2000s. And I was like, oh, I think I missed my moment. And now it's, like, 15 years later. And I was like, this moment is great. I think there's just something to people that you know, the idea that they could become this sort of monstrous, horrible thing with skin falling off and nails all long and gnarled and gross. And I like writing about them, because I've written a few adult things where the zombies are the very scary, creepy, monstrous villains. But here in Last Kids, I was able to use the zombies partly for spooks and for scares, but they end up sort of being more of an annoyance. And then it's these big, almost Godzilla-sized monsters that are the actual very scary bad guys.
So the show has, you've got this launch of the first special on Netflix where the series follows. What's your favorite moment or scene, and what do you want people to take away from it when they watch it?
Favorite scenes, it's the stuff that was directly translated from the book. Like, there's this enemy they meet called the Zombie Ball, which is a bunch of zombies that somehow became kind of entangled together, like those the urban legends about the Rat Kings, where their tails would get all like connected and rats would become like one big giant rat.
Ew.
I remember that from 30 Rock. But they talked about that in there.
I remember
and,
that.
Yeah. And so I had been writing the Zombie Ball scene like 6 years ago or something, and I was like, this is really cool. And then Doug drew it, and I was like, this is really cool. And then when I got to see it animated, like rolling down a hallway of a middle school, chasing these kids in like this sort of Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark opening style scene, I was like, wow, it really came to life. And it was amazing.
There's your imagination on the screen for other people.
Yeah,
to...
like it's there. It's like there. And it's there because there was like 150 really talented people sitting at computers for like a year creating it. And that's also like a wow, like that's just amazing. All the support and faith placed in one idea is a little scary, but amazing. And then I want people to take away, honestly, just a really like a sense of that was 66 minutes of fun, of adventure. It was happy. It was exciting. I liked the characters. It should just feel good. Like, I think even though it's like an end of the world story, the key to it is that there's a heart to it, and that it's like the sort of adventure that we don't get to sort of see that much anymore. It's just kids on their own getting into trouble and like saving the day in a really fun, gigantic way.
That's Max Brallier, New York Times bestselling author of more than 30 books, including the Last Kids on Earth series. The series has been adapted into an animated Netflix show, which premiered yesterday. And the fifth book in the series, The Last Kids on Earth and the Midnight Blade, was also released yesterday. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Woothman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.